It's time for New Media Beat on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Kat Espinal.
And I'm Mahoma Dukre. Welcome to New Media Beat.
New Media Beat is coming to you from Studio A here at OWWR SUNY Old Westbury's web radio station. What do we have this week, Mohammed?
This week we have 6 new stories to share with you.
What's first?
John DeLisa is in the studio to talk about the streaming media industry.
John has a report about Netflix in Mexico. Netflix is investing a lot of money to produce content in Mexico. Why Mexico? What's in it for Mexico? What's in it for Netflix?
New Media Beat reporter Chloe Cutting has our second story. She's on the Marketing Media Beat. Today, Chloe's talking about podcasting and food.
Can food brands use podcasting to market their products?
Our third report is from my co-host, Kat Espinal.
I have a report from the United Kingdom about the Make It Fair campaign to end the unfair use of creative content by big tech companies. Should the big AI companies compensate creators for their work?
Samantha Stuck is our fourth news item today. She wants to talk about TikTok and Apple. What's happening with the TikTok ban? Will it be enforced? Can you still download the TikTok app on your phone?
Mohammed Dukre is our sports media analyst. Mohammed, what will you be reporting on today?
My report is about the NBA. Can you enjoy a basketball game if you can't see the action? NBA teams are exploring new technologies to help the visually impaired feel the excitement of pro basketball.
After that, we are going to talk about artificial intelligence with Deborah Flammenbaum. She's going to explain Google's AI co-scientists. What do scientists think about Google's new tool for scientific research? Will it empower or replace research scientists?
All this and more coming up on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio. Streaming live from the State University of New York, College at Old Westbury.
What's Netflix up to in Mexico? The streaming giant has a plan for a partnership with Mexican filmmakers. John DeLiso is our streaming guru. John, what's behind Netflix's major investment in the Mexican film industry? Why is this global streaming giant spending so much money to make media in Mexico?
Netflix wants to invest more in streaming in Mexico to expand their global content reach. According to Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos, Netflix's investment in Mexico will provide many opportunities for Mexican filmmakers and crew members. Being local is very important to us. It's why all of our series and films in Mexico are made in partnership with local production companies and local partners. We're investing in the creative community and helping talented people find their calling in our industry, Ted Sarandos stated at a press conference in Mexico City. Netflix hopes that expanding content production in Mexico will also provide economic benefits. Sarandos believes that this expansion will boost the hotel industry, local restaurants and catering businesses, and the manufacturing industry as productions utilize those services. Since 2015, Netflix has shifted from primarily American-based content to more global productions. Whether it's South Korea's hit TV series Squid Game to France's Lupin, all of these productions fall under an initiative which Netflix calls its local production strategy.
What is Netflix's local production strategy?
Netflix's local production strategy is a strategy implemented by Netflix to produce more content on a global scale and create content that reflects the cultures where it is produced. According to Ace Lingo, this strategy is about creating content that appeals to a wider audience while also adapting the Netflix platform to varying countries. Netflix's strategy of localization benefits both the service and global consumers. By producing content locally, films and series are more authentic to different cultures and countries. Netflix's newest expansion into Mexico is part of the localization strategy to create more stories that appeal to the Mexican and Latin American market.
Why is Netflix focusing on Mexico for its content production?
Mexico's film industry has proven to be very successful for Netflix. The Netflix film Roma was the first Mexican movie to win Best Non-English Language Film at the Academy Awards. Additionally, Netflix's first ever series produced outside of the U.S. was a Mexican series called Club de Cuervos. Netflix's local production strategy has shown itself to be very important for the service. According to Parrot Analytics, Spanish and Portuguese streaming content increased by 266% from 2020 to 2024. Additionally, the number of Mexican shows on streaming platforms outnumber their other Spanish-speaking countries by 2-1. Netflix is aware of how valuable the Mexican film industry is, and by investing in numerous shows, they are hoping to grow their subscriber base and increase revenue.
What opportunities will this bring to Mexican and Latin American filmmakers?
This investment will bring about numerous opportunities for local Mexican filmmakers. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum stated, "It's not only important for Mexico to be seen in the world, but also because of the economic development and jobs generated by production." According to Grandview Research, the Mexican streaming market is projected to increase its revenue by $8.4 billion in 2030, which is one of the many reasons that Netflix wants to tap into the expanding and popular streaming market. For New Media Beat, I'm John DeLiso. Back to you, Kat.
Thank you, John. Let's talk about podcasting and marketing with Chloe Cutting. Podcasting is an important tool for new media marketing. Chloe Cutting has a report about how major food brands are flocking to podcast studios to lure customers with branded food content. Chloe, what do you mean by food brands? Can you give us a couple examples of the kinds of companies you were talking about today?
Of course. So everyone knows and loves Trader Joe's, the famous grocery store, and they have a podcast called Inside Trader Joe's, which actually got started in 2018 as a 5-episode series. And since then, it's blossomed into a 5-season podcast with over 35 episodes. There's also a company called Blue Apron, and Blue Apron is a meal kit service, a meal kit delivery service, and they offer pre-portioned ingredients for people to cook meals at home. So they offer different level of meals from beginner to advanced across a variety of like dietary options. And they have a podcast called Why We Eat What We Eat. And that podcast basically focuses on food history, nutrition, trends in the U.S., food behavior traditions, and things of that sort.
What makes podcasts more effective than traditional advertising methods?
Podcasts are trending right now. They're very popular across people doing personal brands, so from influencers to actual companies hosting podcasts. And a lot of audiences across various genres are tuned into podcasts, so this allows companies to promote themselves to wider audiences. The 2024 podcast consumer report said that 46% of weekly podcast listeners have purchased a product or service as a result of hearing an ad on a podcast. So not only does it put them in front of wider audiences, but it can also generate more sales as well.
Well, why do you think brands are turning to podcasts as like a marketing tool?
It provides access to a wider and diverse audience, and it also provides an on-demand access to the brand. And in doing so, it creates an intimate relationship between the brand and the consumer. And by doing so, companies can solidify themselves as trustworthy brands, down-to-earth brands, brands that actually listen to the consumers and know what they want and what they like. Lower Street is a podcast production company, and they had a blog, and on their blog post they had talked about some of the benefits around branded podcasts, with the top three being that it increased website traffic. Podcasts can also be monetized, so that's an additional avenue of revenue for companies outside of the traditional services and or goods that they're offering. And it widens the networks and provides diverse perspectives. So with podcasts, they can bring guests on the show that are, you know, well-versed in the prospective field. So in this case, food, you can bring on chefs and or people who manufacture foods or goods that you service and things like that.
How do brands create, like, engaging and valuable podcast content?
So by providing content that aligns with the brand's overall mission and aligns with what the consumers want to see. So in this case, we're talking about food. So for Trader Joe's, a lot of the times people want to know what are the new hot items for the month. A lot of the times Trader Joe's has themed items. They have recipes. A lot of the times people want to know what are the staff's favorites. What makes Trader Joe's Trader Joe's? Because I feel like Trader Joe's is very unique in comparison to a lot of other food grocery stores. Blue Apron, like I mentioned, they offer nutrition tips, cooking tips, history on food. They have an episode on duck sauce and the whole evolution of duck sauce in America. They also gave some information about food and nutrition trends in America as it relates to, like, obesity, health things. And for New Media Beat, I am Chloe Cutting. Back to you, Kat Espinoff.
Thank you, Chloe. Stay with us for my report about a campaign by the creative industries in the United Kingdom. Journalists and media creators are upset about the way artificial intelligence companies are using their content without permission.
Kat, let's be honest, we need to talk about the growing conflict pitting British creators against the artificial intelligence industry. There's a protest movement in the United Kingdom led by the creative industries and the press who are opposed to the unauthorized and uncompensated scraping of creative content to train artificial intelligence. Should content creators be compensated before their work is turned into training data? Kay, tell us about the Make It Fair campaign. Who is involved in this campaign, and why are they, what are they angry about?
So basically, there are many like British content creators, artists, journalists, reporters that are starting to notice that their work is being diminished by big AI companies who are either quote-unquote influenced by their work or just trying to do the same thing they are. So the British create, like a group of British creators have decided to come up with this campaign called the Make It Fair campaign. And basically this campaign is used so journalists and any artists who feel like their work is being diminished or devalued by big AI companies can use this campaign, use this hashtag to make it known and how to express how they're feeling towards these big AI companies.
What is the main goal of the Make It Fair campaign?
Basically, they're not looking for a huge change or a huge like revolution. They just want their voices to be heard and their work to be prioritized, and so they can get their fair share of revenue when it comes to their work. And because this is original reporters, original artists, and content creators that feel like their work is just being copied. So they want the value for their work for themselves. They don't want other people taking their credit.
What kind of changes did the Make It Fair campaign advocate for within the media industry?
Basically, they want their work to be their work. They don't want these big AI companies to come in and start calling whatever they do as an influence. They want their names to be on these work, and they want their names to go out there. For New Media B, I'm Kat Espinal. Back to you, Muhammad.
Thanks, Kat. Samantha Stock is up next to talk about TikTok and Apple. What happened to the TikTok ban? Is there a ban? Will it be enforced? At one point, Apple removed the TikTok app from its app store. Samantha, is the TikTok app back in the Apple store? When did this happen?
TikTok was removed from the Apple store on January 19th after former President Joe Biden signed a law in April that required that ByteDance either sells TikTok to a non-Chinese owner or to be blocked on January 19th. The reason for this ban was because of different issues over data privacy and also potential access to sensitive user information by the Chinese government. So when January 19th rolled around, TikTok was no longer available in the App Store. Individuals who already had the app downloaded with an account were able to use their account, but it was removed, meaning that no new users were able to download the app.
When did TikTok become available again for all users?
Well, to start, it was pretty clear that once President Donald Trump came back into office, he was going to do whatever he could to keep TikTok up and running. Many individuals, especially young adults, were actually voting for Trump for the sole fact that he was promising to work on keeping TikTok. On January 13th, TikTok became available again in both the Apple App Store and Google Play. An article from NPR states, Apple and Google received a letter from Attorney General Pam Bondi informing the companies that the Trump administration will not prosecute them for supporting TikTok. Current President Donald Trump delayed the ban for 75 days, which is now up until April 5th of 2025. According to an article from CNN, TikTok welcomed users back with a notification that said, "Thanks for your patience and support. As a result of Donald Trump's efforts, TikTok is back in the U.S.
Did TikTok have to make changes to secure its place back on user devices?
Yes, TikTok itself had to make a few changes in order to secure its spot back on users' devices. Their main goal was to gain back the trust of both the users and the government due to issues in the past. To start, TikTok made stricter privacy measures. TikTok has now committed to holding U.S. user data on servers that are located within the U.S. only to guarantee enhanced security all over that data. TikTok also consented to sustain regular audits by third-party cybersecurity systems to make sure that TikTok is in compliance with the new data protection regulations. In general, TikTok has also been more open and transparent about how user data is collected, stored, and used since it's been brought back.
Is there a deal to change ownership of TikTok in the works?
Yes. Currently, the White House has been having conversations with Oracle and other U.S. investors to possibly take over. Oracle is an American IT company that makes and also sells software and hardware. Since President Trump issued the executive order that delayed the ban for 75 days, he is able to continue with the sale of the app to a non-Chinese company up until April 4th, 2025, while the app is still allowed to run.
What are the public's concerns about the return of TikTok?
Majority of people have had a good reaction to the return of TikTok. Influencers especially were happy about the return to TikTok, considering it's their life and job. TikTok pages were flowing with videos of influencers who were uploading goodbye and thank you videos to all of their TikTok fans and telling them what other platforms they could find them on once TikTok was down. There's obviously still individuals who are still doubtful about the app. Some may still not trust it, and some may think we're better off without it for the sake of our mental health. The major concerns with the return of TikTok have to do with privacy and security. Lastly, individuals, mostly parents, are concerned about individuals' mental health when using this app so much. Excessive screen time can have a huge impact on one's mental health. All we can do is stay open and optimistic with TikTok's return, hoping it is being used and monitored safely and properly. For New Media Beat, I'm Samantha Stock. Back to you, Muhammad.
Thank you, Samantha. After the break, we're going to talk about basketball with my own report. NBA teams are trying to make it easier for all kinds of fans to enjoy the game. Some fans have difficulty seeing the action on the court. What can an arena do to capture the excitement of fans who can't see so well?
My co-host, Muhammad Degree, has sports news for us. NBA teams are trying out new technology to improve the fan experience. Can a fan enjoy the game when they can't see very well? Can you feel the excitement of pro basketball with these new devices? Muhammad, what are NBA teams doing to make the fan experience more inclusive?
NBA teams are striving towards becoming more sensory accessible for all types of fans. Most people would have a second thought about attending an event in an arena, but there are many people with disabilities that feel arenas aren't suitable for them. Sport events aren't as inclusive as they can be, and NBA teams have been looking for ways to solve this. Recently, an NBA team, the Portland Trailblazers, implemented a device in their arenas called a One Court. This device for people with low vision translates live game play from the basketball game to a handheld device that is shaped like a basketball court.
How does a One Court device work?
This device works by turning live in-game data into vibrations that you follow on the NBA court model device. Each basketball movement has different vibrations that you can follow with your finger to differentiate between a pass, shot, and rebound. The device also has audio capabilities that can allow people to hear if they would like to.
Is this device being used in other sports besides basketball?
This one-court device can be used for sports other than basketball, like baseball. The device can also be of use in arenas in the 2004 baseball All-Star game, like in Globe Life Field. You can also use a device for American football games. For baseball and football, the board changes into a replica of that respective sport and can be followed through vibrations as well. The company hopes to reach to other sports such as hockey and soccer, but those are still in development.
Can you only use this device in arenas?
This device can only be used in arenas and stadiums currently, but One Court is taking pre-orders for when they release them for homes next year. All the device needs is Wi-Fi connection, and you'll be able to watch any game from home. The device, which allows you to switch between games, will help many people with eye disabilities feel as comfortable as others experiencing sports. For New Media B, I'm Muhammad Dukre. Back to you, Kate.
Thank you, Muhammad. Our final report of the day comes from Deborah Feinbaum, who is on the Artificial Intelligence Beat for us. Is AI smart enough to do scientific research? Google has a new tool for scientists. It's called AI Co-Scientist. Will this new tool help scientists with their research? Could it do better research than some scientists? Will it empower or replace human scientists? What do scientists think about Google AI's Co-Scientist? Will they use it? Deborah Feinbaum is ready to explain Co-Scientist for us. Deborah, what is Google's AI Co-Scientist?
Google's AI Co-Scientist is an AI app that was created by Google specifically for scientific questions and research questions. It is an AI-generated app, but it also has extra sync processing power and 4 extra steps. What that means is that Google AI will take the question and will circumvent it 4 times versus normal AI, which will just do it once. And also, in order for you to ask it a question, it requires outside information, lab notes, and other things in order for it to work.
What is Google's AI co-scientist used for?
Google's AI co-scientist is used for scientists who want to fact-check their work by asking it a question. It can also be used by other people who have similar inquiries that could take a while to get an answer for. Like, for example, in the ad campaign, they showed it being used to explain what a sculpture was.
How have scientists responded to co-scientists?
Scientists have had mixed reviews when responding to Google co-scientists. Some scientists think it is a bad thing because it is AI and it is a tool that could be used to replace them. Others fear that it might not be accurate. And some like it because it can be used as a tool to help with experiments.
What was Professor Jose Penandez's response to using Google co-scientists?
Professor Jose Penandez's response to using Google co-scientist was positive because it helped him with his experiment, which was on antibiotic-resistant bacteria. It also made it possible for him to run an experiment and to see if there would have been a different result at the same time without having to rerun it.
How does Google market AI co-scientists to scientists?
Google markets AI co-scientists to scientists by using articles, blog, advertisements, and word of mouth. For New Media Meet, I'm Deborah Flamenbaum. Back to you, Kat Espinal.
Thank you, Deborah.
That's all for this week.
For New Media Meet, it's co-produced by Jaden Nunez, John DeLiso, and Henry Wilson. Our engineer is Jaden Nunez. My co-host is Mohamed Dukre. Thank you, Mohamed.
Thanks, Kat. Today we have reports from Chloe Cutting, John DeLiso, myself, Kat Espinal, Deborah Flamenbaum, and Samantha Stark.
New Media Beat is brought to you by OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio and the Media and Communications Department here at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury.